Ladies and gentlemen, welcome wrestling fans worldwide to Knoxville and the Great Smoky Mountains for the Ron Fuller Tennessee Studcast.
6 feet 9 inches tall, 265 pounds.
This historic podcast from one of the most respected and successful wrestlers and promoters will follow the footsteps of the largest and oldest wrestling family on the planet.
Listen to what I'm saying. That's right. Bring that camera in here a little bit closer.
Through 93 years and four generations.
The stud has arrived.
Old school or new fan, this unique broadcast will educate and captivate as Ron details decades of professional wrestling's growth with truly unforgettable stories.
I want those people out there at home to hear the stud.
Sit back and enjoy the ride with the Tennessee Stud.
The Tennessee Stud. You will learn that name. You will remember it.
And now,
the stud is here.
Hey, everybody. Welcome in. It's time. It's David Summers. And here comes another Studcast with the Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller. It's the story of wrestling in America, as told by the stud, whose family started the profession over 100 years ago. So let's step back into the ring and back into time as we get wall-to-wall, tree-top tall, with the Tennessee stud, Ron Fuller. All right, Ron, what's going on in your world?
Oh, geez, man. Just enjoying the weather. Nice. A lot of trees turned. Beautiful time of year here, man. Really, really appreciate being here, man, in the old Smokies.
Oh, you bet. Yeah, the leaves are falling. So I had a friend of mine the other day said, yeah, I don't know what's killing all our trees. What do you mean killing our trees? What are you talking about? You notice all these leaves falling? He's slow like I am. I got to tell you, these days, Ron, Studcast are literally, I mean, on fire. Record after record gets broken like every week. Last week's Studcast, in my opinion, had to be one of the best professional wrestling history lessons maybe ever. Not only did it involve two NWA world title matches in 1980 with you against Harley Race, but it also went back 22 years earlier to a match with your father where he wrestled Mario Galento in 1958 with a crowd of 40,000 plus fans.
Yeah, I mean... Yeah, last week, man, there were stories within the story, basically, you know, and that match in 1958 was not just my father versus Galento, but it was refereed by the former world boxing champion, the old Brown Bomber himself, Joe Louis, man.
Wow.
So, you know, then 22 years later, a true twist of fate, I was wrestling for the NWA world title, and it just... It just goes on and on, basically, man. I want to take it to another level here. You know, I brought my father down to the ring and I set him down at ringside for that last NWA world title match ever between Harley and I. Mario was the referee and in that one, my dad and Mario ended up at it again.
I mean, to me, that's the type of wrestling history seldom heard, and it's the reason your Studcast have become one of the most popular podcasts in the world, and wrestling world especially. All right, so I think it's also why you've been doing these weekly more than 7 years now, and this one is the 373rd of these. When I was getting ready to put the show together and labeling the files yesterday, I was like, 373 of these, Ron. That's amazing.
Oh, yeah, man. It really is. It surprises me, man. I think the real reason, man, I'm still doing these, Dave, is because the fans worldwide and their tremendous support, and because my audience, it continues to grow, as you just mentioned. And I really enjoy sharing the history of my family, as well as the history of other great stars from around the world. Mm-hmm. There's not a lot, you know, a lot of people out there doing what I do, sharing the glory of old school wrestling, man.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever heard it described exactly that way, Stud. So what kind of glory of old school wrestling are you going to be sharing with us today?
We're going to begin, man, in the old Southeastern Territory in Tennessee, where there wasn't not only a very little glory left, man, up there, and but it had two newcomers, both stars themselves, Ric Flair and Blackjack Mulligan. They were struggling to keep their heads above water. They were trying their hand at owning the company, and they found out how difficult it was. And even having affiliation, they did, with one of the biggest wrestling companies in the world, Mid-Atlantic, owned by the Crockett family, it really didn't seem to have much effect on what was happening there in that Tennessee territory. And we're going to be looking at their card first since buying the territory, their very first card we'll look at today. Then we're going to take a look at the next Southeastern card from the Gulf Coast, and it followed a spectacular 9-day record run we had been on. We're going to become booker than this one. We're going to discuss the difficulties that come with huge cards and how do you keep momentum after these big events. Then after discussing that card, we're going to dive into the TV show promoting it. We're going to give the results of the card, attendances in the three major markets, and then hopefully, Dave, another learning tree question would be nice.
All right. Hopefully we can tack that on the end of the show. It sounds like we're going to be discussing two cards in two different territories. So how to handle difficulties in one of those territories and success in the other, I think, is maybe how you would define the difference between the two. So a TV show, results of matches, attendances, and maybe a learning tree question. With all of that for today's Studcast, it sounds like we'd better start riding. Let's hit the trail. So where are we going to be headed first, Stud?
Well, I want to do a little reconstruction, man, of what had happened in the Tennessee territory since right before the Georgia promoters sold Southeastern to Flair and Mulligan. And none of it had been good news, especially for the poor fans up in that part of the country. The first critical mistake had already been made, in my opinion. The Georgia owners had fired Les Thatcher as their head TV commentator. Now, he'd been there for every Southeastern TV show since the very first one on Channel 10, which we started there in June of 1975. For more than 5 years, he'd been the voice of Southeastern wrestling, and he was just as popular as any babyface that had ever been on there in that territory. And in my opinion, his position behind that desk and in front of that beautiful Southeastern set that we had there was absolutely critical to ever bringing back the huge audiences of the past.
On a recent Studcast, I think after you hired Les in your Southeastern Gulf Coast territory to join Charlie Platt as a second commentator, both of them were heard for the first time ever on a Studcast. And to me, that's only the beginning.
Well, it came, Dave, from one of the first Southeastern TV shows that I've spent years trying to find, basically. And right now, there are more than 70 Southeastern TV shows from the past being placed on my new personal streaming channel, man. And there's going to be so much more to come. We're going to not only do Southeastern, we're going to be streaming Continental. We'll be streaming USA TV shows. Plus, we're going to have a new and a vastly improved Studcast, man, that will allow us to show fans the actual Southeastern TV shows from 44 years ago. Pieces of could show them all, but we'll show pieces of them. I will be taking a lot more time about this in the future, but right now, let's focus on what was happening in Tennessee with the new owners up there. So if you are an owner in the wrestling business, your show, TV show, is by far the most important advertising tool you have. And when it's doing big numbers, you absolutely cannot afford to make a mistake on it. And the Georgia promoter did just that by firing Les Thatcher. There was another huge mistake being made also soon after Les was fired. When Flair and Mulligan took over as owners, they decided not to run any matches at all in the territory for 6 weeks.
Wow.
So I always talk about the importance of keeping good momentum going, a subject we're going to be talking about again later in this show, as a matter of fact. regarding how to follow these huge triple back. We'll be talking about specifically how I tried to follow these huge triple world championship shows that we had had in basically in the last two Studcasts. So the new owners killed their momentum up there in Tennessee, and they could have had they had some momentum because they had made the sale, and they especially were going to be getting all this new talent that was going to be provided from Jim Crockett in the Mid-Atlantic territory. A lot of great wrestlers in that territory. Mm-hmm. And they were going to have, from the very beginning, they're going to have those kind of wrestlers. But after you have 6 weeks and no wrestling, you've killed all your momentum. Fans don't even know whether you're going to be there anymore or not. So, you know, it was a horrible mistake.
Wow. So who was on that first Flair and Mulligan card that was associated with the Mid-Atlantic territory? And I think the date is going to be Friday, October 10th, 1980.
That's correct. You know, they had basically no wrestling in September at all. And now they're basically the second week in October, but having the very first match they'd had. And this one was a double main event card. And the first match was Ben Alexander facing a former star in that Southeastern territory. Way back in 1977, he spent a year there in that territory, Don Canuto. And then Tony Russo was wrestling Nick DiCarlo. Buzz Sawyer, a name familiar, they were familiar with there in Southeastern. And Matt Bourne, they were taking on the New Zealand Sheepherders. And then the first of two main events, Paul Jones, great wrestler. I wrestled him many, many times in Florida in the early 70s, was going to be wrestling against another great wrestler, Ivan Koloff.
Yeah.
And then in the second main event, the United States heavyweight champion, Ric Flair, was going to be wrestling against Greg Valentine.
Okay, so I recognize a lot of those names, obviously, but the card had only five matches, I think. So if the Knoxville fans could have compared it to what was happening in your Southeastern territory on the same night in Dothan, Alabama, with the triple world championship card and eight total matches, I think I know what they would have chosen.
Yeah, I think they definitely would have too. Not to mention the Bob Armstrong and the Stomper and all the other names they were familiar with. No doubt about that, Dave. But this was a very good card, and one of those wrestlers, Ric Flair, was going to be the new NWA world champion and defending in Southeastern exactly 5 months later in Birmingham, Alabama. So he's not going to be the U.S. champion. He's going to be the NWA world champion. So their next big mistake was not running the matches weekly after this one. And, you know, they were coming back. Here they were all of a sudden. They had their first match. But they weren't going to come back for three more weeks to have their second one. And when that did, it was going to be on a Thursday night rather than on a Friday night, which was always a traditional wrestling night for that wrestling in that city and that part of the country. Mm-hmm. And then to make it worse, after that, they were coming back. After that next one, it was going to wait a month to come back. So not running weekly, man, in your major market, if you had a territory, that was basically the kiss of death, man. And it showed me the Crocketts were not going to take this city or territory nor its fans seriously. Obviously, they had been doing it a lot different.
Wow. Okay. So speaking of taking fans seriously, what were you going to do after the triple world championship cards to keep that momentum that you mentioned earlier? You could not have built things up any higher. So I guess it's simpler. How do you follow that?
Well, that's a great question, Dave. And it's one that few bookers, man, had an answer for. A lot of bookers could not do it. Rob was soon leaving the territory. He was going to go book in the Georgia territory. And we'd been running with the same guys in the territory down there for a long time now at this point. So question was, did we stay with the present crew and risk wearing those guys out and then making them less popular when they returned? Or did we start by changing the entire crew or most of the crew? So Bob and I, Rob was going to be gone. Bob's going to be working with me. And so we were in total agreement about this question. And we began to handpick the new crew that was going to start arriving about 2 months later, in about the middle of December of 1980. Lots of bookers would have wanted to keep, obviously, the present crew, giving them too much credit for drawing those nine record crowds of the past 2 weeks. But we both, Bob and I, realized it wasn't our crew that did that. It was that triple world title thing that we stuck on top of our crew. So in the coming 3 months between mid-October 1980 and mid-January of 1981, we were going to move seven wrestlers out of the territory and bring in nine new ones.
All right. So can you tell us who was going to be coming and who was going to be leaving?
Well, you know, off the top of my head, probably not all of them, but I can tell you quite a few of them. Those that were leaving 3 months basically two or three month period of time was my brother Robert. The Mongolian Stomper was going to be leaving. Joe LeDuc was going to be leaving. Don Carson, Ricky Gibson, and Plowboy Frazier. Those are coming in. Paul Orndorff was coming in the territory. Dennis Condrey was coming in the territory. Johnny Valiant out of New York was coming in. Ken Lucas, big name down there in that part of the country. Mr. Saito, a tremendous Japanese wrestler. Jimmy Golden was going to be coming back. Brad Armstrong was going to start working full-time. Oki Shikina was going to be there. And we were going to exchange one of the Gibson brothers for the other one. Ricky was going to be leaving, and Robert was going to be coming in.
All right, that's a lot of big names leaving, but also a lot of huge stars that are coming in. So we're getting close to our break. Can you give us the card? And let's go to the third week in October of 1980.
Okay, I certainly can, man. It was a seven-match card. It had quadruple main events. Had four main events. The opening match was Plowboy Frazier against Billy Spears. Charlie Cook was wrestling Iron Mike Masters. Ricky Gibson was taking on the Super Pro. And in the first of the four main events for the United States Junior Heavyweight Championship, champion Jerry Stubbs was going to be defending against Norvell Austin. The second main event was a Southeastern Tag Championship match, Mask versus Belts, with the champions Robert Fuller and Joe LeDuc losing their belts if they lost the match. And they were going to be wrestling against the Big C 1 and 2. And if those guys lost, they both were going to have to unmask right there that night. Third main event was finally a much-anticipated bull rope match. Basically, been demanded by Ron Bass week after week, who was facing Bob Armstrong for so many weeks straight in a row. Finally, they're going to have that bull rope match. Then the last main event came about basically as a result of the way the last world title match ended the week before. That was when the Mongolian Stomper, basically seeing that there was a fight going on the floor between my father and the special referee, Mario Galento. I had Harley in my Fuller leg lock. And so here comes Stomper up into the ring and that stomps me in the face. And, so the fourth main event was going to settle all that had happened that night. So it was for my Southeastern Championship. The South Mongolian Stomper, managed by the Big C, was facing me. There was no time limit, no DQ, and there had to be a winner for this match because the loser was going to be leaving Southeastern.
Okay, so following the Triple World Championship card the week before, that was still a tremendous seven-match card, a bull rope match, three championship matches, with the loser of the last one having to leave Southeastern. I'll tell you what, we're going to come back after the break, and hopefully we're going to find out who is in the next TV show when this Studcast continues. Stay right there. Hey, Studcast fans, you are in for a real treat. Rod has been working on two major projects for some time now and getting closer and closer to revealing them. One is a fantastic all-new streaming channel that will be filled with just about everything he's ever done from three different wrestling companies, including hundreds of TV shows from Southeastern, Continental, and USA, and every Studcast ever done. More than 373 at this point, and that is only the beginning. Be sure to keep listening every week for the grand opening of the streaming channel first, and then the new Studcast that I'll be talking about more next week. Okay, Studcast fans, welcome back in another Studcast with the Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller. It's number 373. Just think about that for a second. 373 one-hour shows over, I think, like a seven-year period. I think that's called a commitment. All right, so the title of this one, Loser Leaves Makes Southeastern History. All right, so let's get the TV show started, Stud. How did it open up?
Well, when the show started, man, the film, there was a video on. It was already in progress. We had started to do that some. I really liked the look of that when it came right out of the opening. Right there, you're into a really significant match. Happened to be between Harley and I, this one. So the videos from days earlier at the end of the World Championship match with Harley and I had him in the corner, and I was kind of rifling him with a few of those which most guys have considered stiff punches, and Mario Galinto kind of spun me around and he threw a punch at me, and so my father, who was already at ringside, he was right there, within 15 feet of Galinto, and he just came, grabbed Galinto by the leg and drug him out of the ring, man, and started on him outside on the floor. We had 10,000 people in the building that night, man, and obviously, the building exploded, and I'm sure a lot of them wanted to see the old man and Galinto go at it. And so did the fans that were watching in the studio, the TV studio. They had never seen this match, so they're seeing this for the very first time, too. So I put the Fuller leg lock on Harley. It was just basically me and Harley in the ring at that point. And I had him right in the middle of the ring. 10,000 people at that point, they sounded like 50,000. I just went up another notch, another level in volume, man, from the crowd. And again, I was world champion, except for the fact that there was no referee in the ring to hear Harley giving up. It was not a good situation there. And I think everybody knew that was going to be the case, with Mario Galinto being the referee. So the next thing on the video, it showed the Mongolian Stomper. He came into the ring. He stomped me in the face probably two or three times until I let go of Harley's leg. Well, I can't take much of that stomping in the face. And I'm not getting anywhere with the referee. There's going to be no belt for me probably at this point. So Galinto finally got back in the ring, and he had him ring the bell, and then he told him to announce that I had been disqualified. So the bell was ringing at the end of another lost chance for me, man, to win the world title. Last shot of that video, basically it said it all, man. We had hired a brigade of policemen for this event. It was in the 10,000 seat building, and that thing was packed, and those policemen got around Harley and the Stomper, who was still up there in the ring, and Galinto was at that point in the back in the ring, and they got him out of the ring, and they hustled him off to the dressing room safely, which is what the point of having all those policemen was all about. We wanted to. I knew it was going to be a hot finish on all these matches. Several of them that night.
That's a great way to open the show. Okay, so did the did the cameras then, did they like focus on the set with Charlie and Les?
Yeah, as soon as they came out of the video, there was Charlie and Les on the set. And they did, and there was a short discussion between Charlie and Les about the preceding phenomenal 9 days in the Southeastern history. They went back and talked about, you know, they watched this match, and they said this was the fifth time that Ron had wrestled Harley in 9 days. And, you know, they had a discussion about it. And then, as usual, here came the uninvited Big C's, man, to the set. They went, and they interrupted, and then obviously they had to complain about Plowboy Frazier's interference in their last match that cost them the Southeastern tag belts the week before. So, you know, they kind of took over the show, as Carson liked to do. So Big C number one, he asked Charlie and Les if they were going to show what happened to them concerning Plowboy. He said, now that you've shown that video at the beginning of the show today, well, about Ron Fuller and his problem, you're going to show our problem with Plowboy? And Charlie, you know, who was having a constant problem with Carson all the time, he took great pleasure in answering him. He said, no, absolutely not. And he said, we're not going to show that, you know. But he said, I'll tell you what, guys. He goes, since you're already out here, he said, how would you like to stay and see the new champions that just won the belts from you in the first match? They're in the ring there. So, oh, Big C, he was extremely upset now. And, you know, and he basically held his mouth overrun his QD hind end, I think is the way my dad used to put it, you know, and he said, you know, he said, I'll tell you what, he goes, we will be willing to risk our match if these guys will put up those belts against us then in the very next week and put the belts up, and we'll risk our match. And these guys, if they're willing to put up the belts, if we lose, we'll pull our mask off right there in whatever city it is. So the new tag team champions, man, with those belts, were being introduced at that point to a roar by the studio crowd. And that kind of drowned out Carson. And he was still trying to talk, but you couldn't hear what was going on because Rob and Joe was getting such a great reception from the crowd. So the Big C, he'd been rejected enough, I guess, at this point. And him and the Big C, too, they stormed off the set as the new champions basically waded into their opponents in the ring. That made quit work, basically, too, winning the tag match. And they were holding their belts over their head when Les motioned for them to come over to the set. And so on their way back to the dressing room, he said, would you guys be willing to put up your newly won belts here if the Big C's were to agree to both of them unmasking if they lost against you? And both Rob and Joe started laughing. Big time. They said, are you kidding? Of course we'd be willing to do that. No, yeah. So the match was set right there at the set for the following week.
All right, so take us to the next segment, Stud.
Well, Norvell Austin joined Charlie and Les at the set, and he had wrestled the United States Junior Heavyweight Champion Jerry Stubbs to a 30-minute time limit draw the week before in these big championship matches. So and this upcoming week, he was going to get a 6-minute time limit match for the belt. So he knew that he had a 60-minute time limit match coming up. And he barely had time for a comment before Jerry Stubbs brought the belt with him to the ring, long before his scheduled introduction for the second match of the day. And Stubbs had become such a jerk, you know, he knew how to get heat, not just from the wrestlers, but from the fans, but also from Charlie and Les. They were kind of his targets as well. And so Stubbs knew that if he came there and started doing this way too soon, that he was going to make both of those guys angry. And so the ring announcer, he finally went to the ring. And you could tell both Charlie and Les were upset. Stubbs said he'd accomplished what he wanted to. And it wasn't really, he thought, I guess, that it was cute to mess with the show's format. But that was these two guys' job. And, you know, they didn't want to see anybody messing with the format. Here's the way the show's supposed to go down and the order that it's supposed to happen. And, you know, Stubbs wanted to adjust all of that. So by the time Stubbs' opponent got to the ring for the introduction of the match, a second wrestler showed up at the set, Ricky Gibson. And he started talking about his feelings about the United States Junior Heavyweight Champion, Jerry Stubbs. And, you know, and I think that was the whole point for Stubbs. He wanted to be talked about. He wanted to be in the spotlight.
Mm-hmm.
So when Stubbs' TV match started, Norvell and Ricky kind of took turns talking about their feelings about Jerry Stubbs. And he kind of wore, Stubbs was a great wrestler. Wow. And he was wearing out his opponent in the ring. But so Ricky had a really honest to God good beef, man. Stubbs a few days earlier had interfered. Ricky had this match with Les Thornton, the world junior heavyweight champion. And Ricky had waited a long time to be able to wrestle Thornton. And Jerry Stubbs got involved in that match, and he cost Ricky the championship. Ricky could have beaten Thornton, I believe. But, you know, he got Ricky disqualified. So Gibson told Norvell that in Norvell's upcoming championship match with Stubbs next week, he said, Norvell, he goes, I got plans to make you the next United States Junior Heavyweight Champion.
Mm.
and he said, and I guarantee you, you can bank on it. So there was an interesting little conversation between Gibson and Norvell.
Yeah, I'll say. All right, so fans didn't hear that kind of talk very often. It sounds like Ricky Gibson was very serious about this.
He was dead serious about it. You better believe, man. It cost him the World Junior Heavyweight Championship. So you didn't get a lot of chances, man, to win a world title. Believe me, I sure knew that, man. So Stubbs was finishing off his TV opponent, and he was going to have a lot to think about later, though, because he was going to go back and find out what Ricky had said to Norvell. And that should have been interesting in the dressing room.
All right, so that was a really different discussion that just happened at the set during Stubbs' match. Never heard anything like that before. All right, so take us to the personality profile. Set it up for us.
Well, I was with Charlie, man, on the profile set. I had my belt with me. Mongolian Stomper and the Big C. They were in a separate studio with Les, and fans were going to hear, obviously, from both of us during the course of this personality profile. Big C began by bragging about his Stomper taking over the world championship match. That basically, that's what he did do. Big C called all the fans there rednecks, all the rednecks in the studio, and all you rednecks at home. You saw the beginning of that on today's TV show, exactly how my Stomper became the man again, and that's what he is. And then, he did all his normal bragging about the Stomper. And then he said that Ron Fuller should never have been in the ring to begin with. He said, my Stomper is the person that won the tournament, and he should have been wrestling Race to begin with. And he says, and I was just making sure that Harley didn't lose his belt, you know, to one of those Fullers. That's why Stomper went down there. He was just going to make sure Harley was going to walk out of there with his 10 pounds of gold. Big C said the upcoming loser lead match between his Stomper and me was going to be the end of my wrestling for Southeastern and the beginning of his Stomper's complete dominance, I think is the way he put it, in this part of the country. And he said when he got finished, he said, Les kind of cut him off. He had heard enough. And he threw it to Charlie and I in the other studio on the profile set. So Charlie first apologized to me for what had happened in the world title match with me, that they had watched the beginning of the TV show. And that he got right to the point, saying because of that match, this upcoming Loser Leave match was going to be historical. He thought for this wrestling company, really, really a hugely important match. So I talked about that Southeastern history, and I told him, some things that fans I had never told fans before that happened in Knoxville. They weren't aware of Knoxville, and so I told them how in 1975 I won the world title from Jack Briscoe. I actually left the ring with the belt, took it to the dressing room, and they came to the dressing room and got it and took it back and gave it to him. And then in 1976 in Knoxville again, I beat Terry Funk. I was handed the belt. And right there, they reversed the decision and gave the belt back to Terry. And Ronnie Garvin tacked me, sent me to the hospital. I stayed in the hospital for 3 days. And I said that now this time, in this world title match, there was not just one guy in the ring that shouldn't be there. There was two of them in the ring that shouldn't be there. I said Mario Galento nor the Mongolian Stomper had any reason to be in that ring. And again, I said I had the world heavyweight champion beat right in the middle of the ring. And again, another wrestler had the belt taken away from me and stopped me from winning, which was Stomper, obviously, came in and stopped me off. And, you know, so I changed the subject, basically, to the upcoming Loser Leave match. I told fans that Mongolian Stomper and Don Carson, basically, and I didn't call him Big C. I called him Don Carson. I said, the guy that's masquerading as the Big C, basically. Charlie got that quickly. And I said, this time he's gone too far, man. I said, I love Southeastern and I love the people here, but I'm through with wrestling, with other wrestlers getting involved in my business, man. And costing me championships, big championships, world championships. So, I said, once and for all, I want to have a Loser Leave match with the Mongolian Stomper, and I want to get rid of the Mongolian Stomper for good. And I said, when that happens, I said, that's also going to be the end of Don Carson. Because I said, he's just an over-the-hill mouthpiece, man. That's no longer a threat to me without the Stomper or anybody else without the guys that protect him. So I said, I was ready to get in the ring today, in the last match of the day. But that could well be, I said, my last match in Southeastern. But somebody's got to stop these guys like Carson and the Mongolian Stomper. And I said I was going to do my dead level best to be that man next week. I got a huge hand from the studio crowd, and Charlie Platt ended the profile saying this upcoming Loser Leave match could well be the most important match in Southeastern history.
All right. I mean, that was a dead serious personality profile. So take us to the next TV match.
Bob Armstrong was in the ring. Ron Bass had his bull rope. He was at the set with Charlie and Les. Bob was taking care of business in the ring, man, which he always did. And while Bass was busy running his mouth at the set, Bass bragged about this bull rope match being the fifth match in a row against Bob Armstrong. 5 weeks in a row they had wrestled each other. And he says, finally, he's agreed to taking me on in my bull rope match. And, so when Bob was in the ring, he got the studio crowd up as he always did, man. Didn't take him long to really get people. They were so behind him, he didn't have to do too much. Then he ended up putting his sleeper hold on his opponent. And when he did that, then the studio really went nuts. So Bob laid the wrestler down. He woke him up. And then he motioned for Bass, to come on in here, man. You're running your mouth. Come on and get some. But Bass decided he better stay there where he was. And he just kept talking. He said, he was going to make Armstrong extra sorry told both Les and Charlie, he said, I'm going to make him extra sorry for what he just did. When I get him in on the other end of my bull rope, I'm gonna make a new man out of him.
All right. So didn't you say you were in the last TV match, Ron?
Yep, I was on the last TV match of this show, and I got another great welcome from the studio crowd, and I was all business, man, and expecting kind of most anything could happen in this match because we only had one more coming up, man, and if they were able to do something to me in this match, I didn't want to go into a loser leave town match and be hurt. So I was looking out for myself while trying to get myself a good quick win, and and I ended up with a fuller leg lock on the guy that I was wrestling, and then as soon as I got it, man, here came not just the Stomper and Big C, but Big C numbers two and Ron Bass with his bull rope. It was like, wow. So thank goodness I was thinking that, I better be ready for anything. So I got my legs untangled, which isn't very easy when you've got somebody in that fuller leg lock. And I was laying on my back and I just kind of spun around. And Carson and the Stomper were the first two guys to be getting in the ring. And the Stomper was right behind Carson. So Carson, he stuck his head through the ropes. I kicked him in the face with both feet, man. Kicked him back, and he went back into Stomper and knocked them both off into the floor. and then once they were out on the concrete, man, thank goodness my buddies, man, were expecting something at the end of the show too, man. And they were already on their way. Here came Rob. Here came Joe LaDuke, Bob Armstrong. Yeah. They shot up into the ring by me. And so the four of us kind of dared the four of them out there on the floor to come on in, but they decided that they didn't want to do it. So everybody in the building, man, was up on their feet, and wrestlers on the floor. They went back to the dressing room, and the four of us had a little celebration in the ring.
Yeah, I bet. Another great TV show with several very important matches in the coming week. So speaking of that, what happened in the arenas the next week?
Plowboy, and this is, I love this first match. Billy Spears had a lot of heat. I mean, and he'd been there for so many years in that territory, off and on, and he's wrestling Plowboy. If you can imagine Plowboy against Billy Spears, and at the end of this match, Plowboy squashed Billy Spears. I never heard a crowd pop like that. I mean, they wanted to see that, I guess, and I did too. I enjoyed it myself. In fact, Billy Spears disappeared under Plowboy's body. You couldn't see none of Billy. It was all gone. Charlie Cook, in the next match, he got the best of Iron Mike Masters. Good kid out of New York. Ricky Gibson and the Super Pro had a 20-minute time limit draw. And in the next match for the United States Junior Heavyweight Championship, Ricky Gibson was a man of his word on TV, you know. And so he happened to catch the referee down in the match as it was going on with Stubbs against Norvell. And he sneaked into the ring, crawling up on the top rope. Jerry Stubbs turned around, and he drop-kicked him in the face with both feet off the top rope. And Stubbs turned a flip, landed on his face, and then Ricky just went to the dressing room. Norvell Austin walked over there and turned him over and got on top of him, and he won the United States Junior Heavyweight belt, just like Ricky said. So in the mask versus belts match between the champions, Rob and Joe LaDuke, and the masked Big C's, Ron Bass made the difference in this one, man. He came to the ring when the referee was not able to see what was going on. He brought his bull rope with him, and he hit Rob with the big bell on the bull rope, knocked Rob out, and the Big C's got their pin again over on Rob, and they once again became the tag champions. Ben Bass, who didn't ever even leave ringside after winning that tag match for the Big C's. And he basically waited for Bob Armstrong with his bull rope out there. And I'm sure he was expecting that he was going to leave some blood everywhere. You know, these guys had just been had bloody matches. Now they're going to have a bull rope match, which is definitely always a bad thing to get yourself into. So Bob held his own and in the bull rope match. And so, well, in fact, that at the end of it, Bass tried to leave the ring, but they were connected to each other. So he had a hard time doing that. Finally pulled Bob out of the ring. And then Bob had to go down to get him, try to get him to keep him from getting back to the dressing room. They fought all over one part of the building there. It was crazy. And Bob followed him back there. And then when Bass got back toward the dressing room, he managed to get the rope, his bull rope, off of his hand. And when he did, he shot into the dressing room, disappeared. So Bob had the bull rope, and he came back to the ring, and he swung it around his head, and they got his hand raised, and he left with Bass's bull rope. So then in the loser leave Southeastern match between myself and the Mongolian Stomper, who was managed by the Big C, there ended up a whole lot of people in the ring in this one. I mean, the TV match was about the situation like that, but this one did turn into a situation where a whole lot of guys came down and got involved in this. And because this was a no DQ match, and because there had to be a winner, the match continued until everybody involved. And then the referee, how are you going to, he couldn't control six or eight guys that were in the ring. Big C kind of got caught me off by myself on one side of the ring, referee on the other. And he had his loaded glove, and he knocked me out with his glove. And I lost probably the biggest match, one of the biggest matches I ever did. And I had to leave Southeastern.
Wow. Okay. So I bet there was a lot of unhappy fans on the end of that night. So how about the attendances in the three major markets, Stud?
Well, Montgomery did very well, considering the phenomenal card from the week before, Rob. And I've been very concerned about these cards dropping in half or something. But it didn't. It held very good. In fact, it had 4,500 fans in Montgomery. Dothan packed them out again. It's had another 5,000 people in there for this card. And Mobile sold out Expo Hall with 6,000 fans.
All right, you've done it again, Stud. Another great Studcast. And it looks like we're in luck. We're going to have time for a learning tree question. Let's get to that right away. This one comes from Jody Jenkins in Boise, Idaho. He asked, what kind of promotion did your father have to do to get anywhere near the thousands and thousands of fans for a wrestling match in Mobile, Alabama, 1958? That's solid right there. I want to hear this.
Boise, Idaho. My gosh, man. Hey, he's way out there. That's a very good question, Mr. Jenkins. I mean, how do you do that and draw that bigger crowd, you know? I think the first thing he did, you know, in answering your question, Mr. Jenkins, the first thing that comes to mind, that he did something that hadn't been done very much at all. And he created basically a card on this night in which he's wrestling Mario Galento, or that wasn't a wrestling match, no wrestling to that match. It was all a fight or a brawl. And this match got started, and he had multiple championship matches on this. And I think it's one of the first times probably that he ever tried it and ever did it. It kind of reminds me of what we had done the last two Studcasts back in 1980 with three championships on one card. Well, he had multiple championship matches on this card in Mobile that drew the 30, 40,000 people. And then it was involving champion wrestlers. Well, he had brought in a lot of wrestlers that had big names from other places around the country. Fans back in those days had the old wrestling magazines and things like that. Mm-hmm. And they would find and see pictures of guys and they always wanted to say, well, why doesn't he ever wrestle here?
Yeah.
So Dad brought a bunch of those people in along with this main event with him against Mario Glinda.
Wow.
So another thing was also going on there, Mr. Jenkins, I think the name was, was that my dad was already at this point drawing huge crowds. And he was running in the baseball field in the summertime, and they were doing 9,000 people in the baseball field. They were selling out the baseball stadium and the baseball field. So, he was already drawing some big crowds. How was he going to get to 30 or close to 40,000, so he was already doing 9,000 a week. So obviously back in those days, and also too, back in those days, people believed in wrestling more than what they did, in today's time as an example. Mm-hmm. I mean, wow, it's nothing like it used to be. So, and back in those days, when you're drawing 9,000 people, you've got a fan base that believes in what they're seeing, and they love what they're seeing. So you've got a huge base there, basically, So, and to make it even more convincing, my dad was he wanted people to believe, man, and so. To make it even more convincing for the fans, my father took things to a level, man, that as far as I know, had never been done before. I don't think I've never heard of any place else or any other type of thing that was handled like this particular event in Mobile back in 1958.
Mm-hmm.
And in order to do what he wanted to do, he had to have an opponent that was willing to do anything,
right? Yes.
And he found himself a madman named Mario Glinda, who was definitely willing to do anything. You can do whatever you want to with me, and none of it can ever be as much as I want to do, right? So first, man, they did an angle to build for this match to get did something here again that had never been done, in which they were going to have a shoot basically between him and Mario, which meant that they were going to bust each other open hard way and they were going to do it right there in front of a bunch of people, So this, I'll call this, I guess, the warm-up shoot, man, got the fans into this potential match, right? So, and they went to an extreme, man. It was certainly beyond all others, man. But nothing was going to compare to this actual match when it really went down. But they accidentally, or they made it appear that they accidentally ran into each other in a restaurant in downtown Mobile, middle of the day, noontime. And as soon as they went in, Dad went in there. Glinda was already in there. They just started fighting in the restaurant. They tore that restaurant up. And then they had a fight, man. They turned the tables over, and they were busting each other open, and they were bleeding like crazy. And they fought to the outside of the restaurant, and about the time they got there, the police started showing up. They called the police, the owners of the restaurant, they couldn't control this. And first of all, the dad said there was only like three or four police that showed up, but he said, but before this was all over, there was going to be about 10 or more of them, right? So the police recognized my dad and Galinto, you know, because the wrestling TV show back in those days was one of the most popular shows on television.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody knew who these two guys were.
Yeah.
And the cops were afraid to try to stop them. They just backed off and let them fight. God. Right. Now they're at least outside, right, rather than in the restaurant. So my dad had a Cadillac, and he had parked across the street from the restaurant. Mm-hmm. So they fought their way across the big main street, and their traffic cars all stopping, and they're having a hell of a fight. And so they fought their way over to where the car was. And so my dad grabbed Mario Galinto, and Galinto had this long black hair, like a woman's length hair. That was part of his gimmick.
Yeah.
And so my dad grabbed him by his long black hair by the back of his head, and he slammed his face into the hood of that Cadillac. Now, back in those days, 1950s, those cars were made like tanks.
Wait, there was not a fiberglass hood on that car?
Oh. No, man. It was a bona fide piece of steel, hunk of steel.
You bet. Right? Wow.
I mean, and so he slammed him face first onto the hood of the car. They'd already been fighting, Dad said. The fight might have been 6 or 8 minutes in, and they'd fought across the street. And he said, and when he slammed his face into the car, he knocked him out. That's the only way Galinto was going to quit. I mean, you know, and so he slammed him hard enough that Galinto was knocked out. He was unconscious, and it left a big dent from Galinto's head in the hood of the Cadillac, right? And so, so then basically the fight was over. Galinto went down, and then all of a sudden the police said, "Well, heck, we got a chance to stop this, right?
Yeah.
One of us getting hurt, or some of us getting hurt." So they basically grabbed Dad, they handcuffed him, and they finally got Galinto up and got him conscious, and they handcuffed him, and they took him to jail. So, and as you might imagine, man, after a deal like that, it was front page, Mobile paper the next day, for 2 days, basically.
Wow.
They even had pictures. I remember as a kid seeing the pictures of the dents in the car, in the hood of Dad's car, where it was people had taken pictures of where he slammed Mario's head, you know, and then they had descriptions of the fight. So wow, this is how they set up to have this big match. So, and then, in my opinion, Dad was so far ahead of his time, you know. I think, in my opinion, then came the coup de grace for this whole deal, man. He did something that may have never been done before, and I don't believe it probably had, no doubt about it, and especially down in that part of the country. So he picked his referee for this match, you know, he was smart enough to say, we need to have somebody that's famous, right, you know, and so... he found him an Alabama guy who happened to be one of the most famous athletes in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And he got the former world boxing champion, the old Brown Bomber himself, Joe Louis, to referee the match. Now, Joe Louis was when he put Joe Louis at the top of that card as the referee, that's going to draw you 10 or 20,000 people to say they saw Joe Louis,
mm-hmm.
right? So he refereed the main event between my father and Mario Galinto, and months later, that's where that picture that we ran last week as part of the studcast with Galinto and all those black eyes and stitches and what had happened to him, that's where that picture came from. It came from that match. So after all that, my father, then he knew it was going to be big. So he knew he couldn't put all the people into the baseball stadium. So he got the biggest venue in that entire part of the country. He went and put this match in the Ladd Memorial Football Stadium, where they used to do the college games, where the players used to go and they select college players, man, put into the pros. So he took this match to Ladd Memorial Football Stadium, and basically, Mr. Jenkins, the rest is history.
Well, yeah, I certainly buy that.
Hey, thank you very much, Mr. Jenkins. What a great question, and I hope I've answered it to your satisfaction. And I also like to say, Mr. Jenkins, you are out there in one of the most beautiful parts of this country, man. I have been to Idaho and Montana, and it's just a great area, great place to live out there. And thank you very much for your question.
Hey, I got to tell you, I could get you to go on for quite a while because I was just looking to at TNstud.com. TNstud.com, if you look under Studcast, you can go back all the way to the very beginning where the stories were really thick, and you can certainly find this story in way more detail, which is why I was saying there's so many more questions that could be asked, like, how did your father... You said he contacted people from all over the nation that came in for this event. And then so how did he do that? A lot of details behind the scenes. So I think you've absolutely done it again. I have more questions than answers, and you gave us a bunch of answers. So, all right. So the gentleman from Idaho, thank you again. I think that's so cool that he came up with that and he brought that history into the show. All right. Another great one, Stud. So I don't know where, how, what you're going to do to make it better next week. So give us an idea of where we're going to ride on the next show.
Well, we're going to briefly, man, be returning to Knoxville. We're going to talk about another Ric Flair and Blackjack Mulligan and Mid-Atlantic card, the second card, basically. And the next one is going to be on a Thursday night. I think I mentioned that earlier, October 30th, to be exact, we'll be talking about in 1980. And then we're going to drive, man, dive right back into Southeastern. And I may have gone from the territory at this point, but not my brother. And he's going to be looking to get even with the Stomper and the Big C for the fact that I'm no longer there. And the next card has two loser leave matches on it and three championship matches. And I'm also going to be going to talk about what's coming. You and I both, we're both aware of this, Dave, but fans aren't, we're really working toward creating a new streaming channel. It's going to be the best thing that I've ever done before. It's going to contain all of the things that I have ever done, all of my Southeastern TV shows, my Continental, my USAs, every one of the 373 Studcast at this point, and so much more. The shows that I have done and pieces of things. So I think it's going to be one of the most interesting streaming channels in all of wrestling. And it's going to allow us to run matches, and we're going to have a new Studcast, basically. And I'm not kidding about it being new. It's going to be a totally new and improved Studcast. It's going to allow us to run live matches, actual interviews from original shows in 1980, 1981, the original Southeastern TV shows. Because now I've laid my hands on so many of them, I can actually be able to show fans. And instead of just being an audio version where they can't see us, Dave, they're going to be able to see us. And they're going to be able to see actual TV shows. So I think it's going to change everything for us. And hopefully we're going to have another Learning Tweet question again next week.
All right. A jam-packed show next week. You can count on that. All right, folks. You know how to get up with Ron, the Tennessee Stud, on Facebook. Find Ron at Ron Fuller, the Tennessee Stud. Like and follow him there. Automatically become friends with a living legend. Twitter or X. It's just as simple. Ron Fuller Welch. follow him there also. Check out the fantastic website at tnstud.com. tnstud.com. This studcast is going to be there with every studcast ever done. The stud store is where you can get 43 super studcasts, four different 8x10 photos, the best-selling novel Brutus, personally autographed to you. You can get hooked up with that and subscribe to Ron's YouTube channel called Southeastern Rewind. Find hundreds of hours of classic old-school wrestling entertainment, 448 total videos, the last 151 studcasts, Ask the Stud shows, and short rides with the stud as well. You can go back 1 year or more, discover fantastic stud stories, worldwide stars, studcast archive stories, tell me more fan question shows, superstars of the past shows, and so much more. It's YouTube, Southeastern Rewind. It's the best deal in wrestling. All right, any final comments, Ron?
Yeah, I'd like to thank everybody, man, for joining us again today. And I can't express how much we are looking forward, man, to all these new things coming in the studcast world, I guess is a good way to put it. It's going to be a whole different game from what we've been doing for the first 7 years. And please take care of yourselves and others, and may God bless us all.
For Ron Fuller in the Great Smoky Mountains, I'm David Summers saying thank you for listening. Find me on Facebook at facebook.com/dsummers955, on Twitter, X, Dave_Doohan. On Instagram, it's instagram.com/DavidSummersProductions. And hit me up anytime at davidsummersproductions@gmail.com. This studcast is a David Summers production. For Tennessee Stud, LLC.
Thanks for joining us today for this historic studcast. The true story continues next week. So fool Nelson your friends and point them in our direction for another ride with the Tennessee Stud.
One, two, three.
This is David Summers saying so long from the Great Smoky Mountains.